Hello there, and welcome to the Authentic Recruiter Podcast. I'm your host, Claire Ackers. This podcast is all about what it really takes to grow a profitable and purpose-led recruitment company. In this space, you can expect to be inspired, you can expect to be empowered, and you can expect to be equipped with everything you need to achieve the recruitment business of your dreams. Thanks for tuning in. I'm so glad you're here, and let's jump in to the episode. Today, I am delighted to be joined by Tracy Fletcher, who is Managing Director of Campbell and Fletcher. Tracy, thank you so much for being here. How are you doing?
I'm great. Thank you, Claire. And thank you so much for inviting me on. I've been looking forward to having a bit of a break from the world of recruitment, having a good chinwag this afternoon. So
well, I'm very, very excited because we've only just recently come into each other's worlds, haven't we? And we had an amazing conversation. Well, the first couple of times we've spoken, so I cannot wait to see
what little gems I've got for you. Yeah,
exactly that. So start us off then. Tell us a bit about your story and how you got to be where you are, if you would.
Okay, yeah. So first words coming out of my lips could kind of split the audience already. So I'm a banker by profession. So I started life at Midland Bank back in 1986. And it wasn't a career move. And I think this is probably going to resonate with a lot of the audience, and especially a lot of women who, you know, I went to Heppenwright Grammar School. It was a great school. I got to 18, didn't want to go to university, had no blooming idea what I wanted to do. And I was went for an interview at Yorkshire Bank and Midland Bank, and I got the job. In fact, I had a bit of a segue to an accountancy practice for 6 weeks, but the man that they put me in the room with just farted all the time, and I just couldn't bear it. So I applied for the job at Yorkshire Bank and one at Midland, and I got both jobs, which was hilarious. And I remember going back home to my mum and dad and saying, look, you know what, I've got a job at a bank and I'm going to do it until I find out what I really want to do. And then you fast forward 20 years and I was still in the bank. And I built a really good career. You know, a lot of people in and around the region know me, and, you know, that I had a very successful career with HSBC. And my last role before leaving the bank was a senior role looking after Sheffield, so business banking, retail, premier banking. So kind of I ran a cluster of branches, and I think I had 100 staff. You know, it was, I don't even know how I got to that stage. I think I just fooled everybody for 20 years. And then I had a little bit of a tragedy is probably a strong word, but I lost both my parents when I was 36, and they died within 6 weeks of each other.
Wow.
Of cancer. And literally it's one of those moments, isn't it? So I just thought, I could see my next job in the bank, which looked a big, scary job, really mm-hmm. big and scary, kind of not 100 people, but more like 2,000 people to manage. And then I looked at the, you know, kind of, and we talk a lot about, I'm sure we'll talk a lot about values in this interview, but, you know, the job I had was quite hard anyway, because I love managing people, but there is a cost to you as a person when you manage people, because you get involved and it drains you a little bit. And I thought the next job I had was going to be making decisions that's based on statistics and the balance sheet and my P&L, and not about people's lives and individuals. So I just so happened to come across one of the bank manuals, there was a scheme for senior managers where you could take a sabbatical. And it was it wasn't paid, so it was unpaid, but it was, you could have up to 5 years off, and you could have up to three kind of different spates off, and you guaranteed that you came back on the same salary, the same grade, and you didn't have a break in your pension. And I just thought, do you know what, this would be quite a good time to do that. So I decided to take a small sabbatical, and I think the day after the first day off, I was like, yeah, I'm not going back. This feels great. I've got none of the stresses and strains. You know, I've not got all the, again, banking's brilliant, but it's a tough gig when you get to that level. So, and my husband was brilliant for the first 3 months, and I kind of fannied about a little bit. You know, I was approached by St. Luke's Hospice. I went to do some consultancy work for them, and then ended up being a trustee there. And And my husband then just said, what are you going to do, Trace? And I was like, don't know. Anyway, I put him off for a bit. And then literally he was starting to go, you know, what are you going to do? And I said, I'm going to start a business. And he then said, what's that going to be? And I had no idea where it came from. And I just went, I'm going to go into recruitment.
No idea where that came from?
No. Well, wow. Subliminally, I kind of remember afterwards. So and basically my thought process, I think, was, although I was a little bit panicked about the whole being put on the spot about starting to earn a living again. Mm. And so I think my thought process was, what was, I've worked in banking for 20 years. My last job, I had a massive team and I had massive problems with external recruitment.
Yes.
I had attrition because that's what retail banking is. And I had a lack of expertise with the external recruitment that they were trying to bring people in. Mm-hmm. And that was what was in my head. But then when I reflect, and I'm going to answer this, the last question first, I think, now. So when I was on holiday after my mum and dad died, I went, worked through a book called What Colour Is My Parachute? And
I have it on the shelf.
I've got the 2020 version.
Well, I've got 2007 back there.
Oh, I'll lend you 2020. Just the same, to be fair, Claire. And literally, when I worked through that book, and that was back in 2005, and I didn't leave the bank till 2006, my two ideal jobs, if you like, were recruitment or a librarian. Now, those of you who know me that know librarian is a big thing. I'm looking at the stack of books there. So that's what I did. And it's interesting because despite the fact I am a banker by profession, I spend my life lending money to businesses and being very specific about the business plan that they needed to give me, the cash flow forecast that I required and all the strategy information. I just started it. I didn't have any of that stuff. I didn't even know any of the terminology, and I still don't. I still get contingent, and I just do. I'm just like, I don't know. And to make matters worse, I decided I wanted to go into business with somebody. I didn't want to do it on my own, and I had somebody in mind, but her circumstance had changed. And then a lady called Charlotte Hopkinson, as she is now, turned up at my husband's bank. So he'd moved on to Handelsbanken, and she was signing some security documentation. And he said, just as a throwaway, what do you do, Charlotte? And she said, oh, well, I'm a lawyer by profession, but I'm in recruitment at the moment. And he said, you want to speak to my wife? She's setting up a recruitment company. And the rest is history.
So, wow. That is quite a tale. There is so much I want to go into in that. But just back up a second, because there's something you mentioned before, which is really, really interesting. So I don't know if you even remember saying this, whether it just came out of your mouth, but you said you had 100 people working for you, you had 20 years in banking. And I can't remember the exact phrase you used, but there was a little flash go on my head that said imposter syndrome. It was something like, they hadn't found me out. So how did you go from feeling like that to going, you know what, I am setting up my business, I'm going to get my first partner, employee?
She was my business partner.
Even though you had 20 years behind you in banking, and I still felt like imposter, to go, I'm setting up a business and it's going to happen. How did that work in your mind?
I think sometimes, what a big corporate organization is very good at is making you believe you're not very good. And part of that, actually, it's not HSBC's fault. It's actually HSBC is very good at attracting talent. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I would say there's a couple of banks, Barclays being another, where the employees are really high caliber individuals. So you're being pitted against people who are incredibly bright, incredibly ambitious, and probably have a bit more of a cutthroat personality than me. You know, I'm a lot of my friends say that's just rubbish, but I can be quite a soft touch, and I feel things. So, you know, even though technically I could do my job, I knew exactly what I needed to be doing. Sometimes it didn't feel nice to do those things. And I think that's probably where I felt, you know, I'm not a ball breaker. I never have been, and I never will be. Mm-hmm. And it took me from to leave the organization to realize that I didn't need to be. Mm-hmm. So I think, you know, I worked in an environment that is predominantly male oriented. Again, it wasn't toxic. I don't even think it was. It was just a specifically male environment where tough decisions got made, and back to authentic self. Mm. A lot of people must have felt exactly the same as me, but never said it. Yeah. But, you know, my authentic self said, I don't like doing some of this stuff. And therefore, does that mean I'm not a great leader?
Interesting. As you're speaking, the word that's coming up for me is unfettered.
Yeah.
As in you were put in a box, you were forced to work in within the tried and tested structures. But you had this chance to take the sabbatical, you took it. And then this whole new level of you emerged, and you were just free to just create something, and it's turned out to be this business. How exciting.
Yeah, and I think, you know, I think that's kind of when you look at how we operate as a business. You know, I still don't know some of the terminology. I don't know how a recruitment company should look.
Well, that's part of the fun, isn't it?
Yeah. So I kind of just decided that I wanted to create something that was a relationship management company, really. Mm-hmm. You know, so that I took all the skills and expertise that I've built of these and didn't throw that away, because that was important to me. You know, I'm proud of that career. I'm proud of knowing what I know about banking. Mm-hmm. But then being able to say, well, actually, if I wanted to create something that is, considered to be best in breed for what we do, mm-hmm. and to do the best job I possibly can, I don't need a framework to work in. Yeah. I need to just trust in my, and we talk about this a lot in our company, my moral compass. You know, what feels right, what's the right thing to do, how to deliver the best. Because I mean, back in the day, I mean, it's not so much now, is it, Claire? But back in the day, in 2007, when I launched the company, we were earning good money. The margins were pretty eye-watering, especially if you've got a client who was really kind of blasé with the checkbook. And even right at the beginning of that, I thought, if we're earning that much money, we have to earn it. Mm-hmm. You have to be showing that you're doing something more than just a bit of luck. You know,
yeah, absolutely. It's a very common theme, both on this podcast and in my work, is the question and the challenge of how to move away from being seen as a Me Too recruiter. You know, 39,000 recruitment companies in the UK. How on earth do you differentiate yourself? And it sounds like you actually, it's not naivety. It's the freedom, that word freedom again, that you didn't know how things were supposed to be done. I'm making air quotes, and therefore you made up your own rules. And it's that wonderful, inspiring, empowering feminine energy of just following your intuition about what feels right. And so many companies don't feel able to lean into that. And that's beautiful.
Yeah. And I think that is the thing. I mean, I'm very lucky in as much as I took the decision, because I've been a leader for a lot of years, so I think it would be difficult for me to then take to follow anybody else's rules. So that part of it was quite easy. The fact that when I came out of the bank, I realised that actually I'm quite clever, because when I'm looking at people who weren't in my work environment, I realised that the bank had done me well by, all the training and development it had done, all the leadership training, all the negotiation, all that kind of thing. And I felt a bit more confident in myself when I was away from the environment and was able to take stock about who I was as a person. Mm-hmm. And the other bit of luck and is the network, because, you know, I'd spent 20 years working in financial services, and albeit I didn't know many other bankers apart from HSBC bankers, we'd already started dispersed and moved to other banks, so that didn't take long to build that network. And you know, I'm of the opinion that you should always treat people nicely. You know, I mean, you should always be respectful and kind, whoever they are. So I think that actually played into my hands when I was, because there was a lot of people wanting to help. Mm. You know, that if I'd been a bit of a ball breaker in the bank, maybe they wouldn't have been quite so accommodating. Mm.
Tell me about the business then. Tell me about the values that you stand for and what you're really proud of in the business that you built.
I'm just incredibly proud of the business because, you know, there's something so magical about starting your own brand and 15 years down the line. So 20 years in banking, 15 years in recruitment, to have a brand that is recognizable within financial services and considered to be, we're considered to have a lot of integrity, which is one of our core values. So integrity is really important to us. And, you know, how we demonstrate that is, you can see on the outside looking in, you can see some bum fights in recruitment. You know, you can see the fastest finger first approach. You can see the let's get a CV over to a client without actually remembering to speak to the candidate about it. You can see the kind of intrinsic bullying of candidates who, they've sent a CV and you know full well that they've not spoken to the candidate, but you know the recruitment company has more or less said, if you don't let us represent you, we'll make sure you don't get this job. However, subconscious, you know, kind of under the covers have done it. So we just, anything like that, we walk away. Mm. We just walk, even if we know we are absolutely, you know, we know that we've got physical proof that that's the case. We never pursue this, because at the end of this, in the middle of this, is a poor candidate who is desperately trying to find a job. Mm. And, you know, us not doing the right thing could mean that that candidate doesn't get the job, because the client is just going to go, this is too hard. Mm. We're going to be in litigation if we're not careful. Mm. So, you know, one of the things that we're really keen in our business is that moral compass. Are we doing the right thing? Generally, what we find is because we have done the right thing historically, it tends to come out. And I'll give you a really good example. Mm. We were engaged by Bibby Financial Services, great company, invoice finance provider. And we were engaged with them. And on our very first role, our very, very first role, we presented a candidate. And this is how we operate. So how we operate is we get the brief, we speak to the hiring manager, we listen to exactly what the brief is, we deliver on that brief, albeit if we think there is a candidate that's not quite the brief, but we can see something, we might present that candidate, but with a full précis of why we've gone off brief a little bit. Mm-hmm. So we speak to the candidate, we sell the values of that client to the candidate, and we present the candidate. We're not the quickest because we do it right. And then it was the first candidate we presented for Bibby's, and the head of HR, lovely, lovely woman, Sarah Cook, hope you're listening, said, oh God. And she says her heart dropped because she said the first time we've used this agency and we have the CV already. So she rang me. No, I rang her and I said, look, mate, don't even worry about it. We'll back out. It's not a problem. Let's not muddy the waters at this point. We'll have lots of other opportunities to do it. Let's keep the candidate in process. And literally about a month later, the other agency were dropped off their PSL and not doing the right thing. And she writes about my company in her blog nearly every month about this is what a recruitment company that does the right thing looks like. And we went on to do Bibby's recruitment for 10 years.
Hey, it's Claire here, just jumping on to check whether you have taken my recruitment impact and income scorecard. It's a short quiz, just 30 questions, and at the end, you will get your score and your personalized report. So if you're looking to grow a profitable and purpose-led company, what are you waiting for? Take the scorecard totally free of charge. There is a link in the show notes. Let's get back to the episode.
The other thing that we're really keen on is about how we connect with the client. So, and there's no right or wrong, but we will, if we engage with the client, we'll do everything that we can. But don't give us developers because we're not very good at that. If we engage with we're on HSBC's panel, and if they bring us a £22,000 credit control role or a £200,000 head of role, we will engage because we've spent that time understanding that business and working with that business, that, you know, we like to consider ourselves a bit of an extension of their company. We're their brand advocates. You know, we know enough about them to understand culturally what they're looking for.
So I'm old enough to remember 2008, 2009, and the fun times it was in recruitment then. And, you know, we're still here, might have a few more grey hairs and wrinkles, but we're still here, we're still in the industry, still fighting. And what I remember from that time is a lot of companies cutting corners in order to survive. What advice would you have for a company that's listening to this, or a recruiter that's listening to this and is a bit worried about the upcoming challenges that are heading our way, on how to retain that integrity, you know, when things are getting a little bit tough?
I it's interesting because, you know, one of the questions that you said that we might cover off would be what's the
I don't think I've asked a single question. No, that we've meant to yet. Sorry.
It's all right. We're like a chat. So biggest challenge you face. Well, actually starting a recruitment company in financial services a year before the biggest financial crash in financial services that ever happened was a fairly big challenge. And, you know, we approached it. So it's quite interesting because when we started, we were a banker and a lawyer. I mean, there's six of us now, and my business partner now, my co-director, is another banker. And let me tell you, we are frugal. So that's the first thing I would always say. You know, we've always underspent. And I know that's a bit counterintuitive for a lot of people, that, you know, you should be having this great big flashy building and you should, you know, you'll be all be kind of creating this smoke and mirrors approach, just that you're a lot bigger. But we literally cut our cloth accordingly from the beginning. Mm-hmm. And until we could cover the costs of an employee for a whole year, we wouldn't take another person on, which was very challenging at the beginning because we were working a lot longer hours. But that was again, the moral compass. You don't bring somebody on to join your business if you think there's a possibility you're going to make them redundant because you've not got enough money. So that's what's meant that we've got a staff that have been with us for years that don't move on, because it's doing the right things for the right reason. So we started small. When the financial crunch happened, we had already established, and again, we didn't take on hundreds of clients all at the beginning. We just took enough clients on so that we had a spread, but not too many that we couldn't build that relationship and keep that relationship. So we diversified a little bit. So we made sure that we could act quickly if we needed to come out of it. So recruitment lends itself to a lot of things. We ended up picking a contractor with the Department of Work and Pensions to give career coaching to out of work bankers and lawyers and accountants.
Nice.
So, you know, it's being able to think a little bit outside of the box about what your transferable skills might be and how you could kind of utilize your skills in a different circumstance. So we did that. What else did we do in that? We were kind. And again, through the pandemic, because we had no work in the pandemic at all. Mm. So, you know, I don't think many recruiters were still recruiting, not in financial services anyway. So we were signposting candidates to clients for free. Wow. Because why wouldn't you? They're our clients, and this is a person who's out of work and is worried about paying the bills and things like that. I did a lot of coaching, a lot of career coaching. I picked up a couple of mentees to help. And literally, it's karma. It's what goes around comes around. So as soon as the everything starts to pick up again, those candidates and those clients who we'd helped, and the other thing is the sons and daughters of clients that come out of the woodwork. Hi, so-and-so has just graduated. Would you mind doing a bit of a pep talk with them? Yes, of course I will. But all these things come round. You have to ask yourself inside, am I doing the right things for the right reason? You don't do it because you think you're going to get something at the end of it. You do it because you genuinely want to help somebody. But generally, the rule of thumb is it does come back. In spades. So yeah.
That really, really shines through. And I think, well, I hope will be a bit of a comfort to people who are listening to this, who are perhaps being a little bit worried, but you're absolutely right. It's, we're in it for the long game. Don't panic, keep your head and think smart about it as well, I think. I want to change tack slightly. I'd like to talk about network. Okay. We obviously met through through network. You were very kind enough to be, well, I think you were volunteered, weren't you, to represent one of your trustee positions for an event I was running for Lean in Leeds. Talk to me about your trustee positions, first of all, because it sounds like that's really, really important to you to maintain that those connections with people and not just for business reasons, but to give back.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think if you, you know, when I talk about some of the positions I have, that bar one, there is a theme with them, because, you know, being a financial services professional, a woman in financial services for the last 35 years in one way, shape or form, has meant that, you know, one of the things that I'm really big on is supporting other women. Mm. You know, I remember when I was supported by other women in HSBC, and there was a lot. There's a woman called Irene Dorner who was my mentor, and there was a fabulous woman called Lynn Walker, who's now at Lloyds, I think. But she taught me how to be an authentic woman and not to be myself, to understand that it's okay to be the person I am and be a good leader and things like that. So I know the value of supporting women and the kind of things that we face and how our minds work a little bit different. So, and it's back to that authenticity, isn't it? So to be able to say to other women, you know what, I'm not perfect. Sometimes I cry. Sometimes I am frustrated. Sometimes I drop the ball quite significantly. But that's okay, because if you then comparing yourself to somebody who pretends that they are perfect all the time, you're going to always fall short. So I was approached, 2019, to initially be a career coach for a fantastic charity called SmartWorks. We have a centre in Leeds that opened in November 2019. And what we do is we provide interview clothing and interview coaching to women who are trying to get back into the world of work. You know, some have been stay-at-home mums, some are just a victim of the pandemic, others have had very difficult circumstances, maybe coming out of the prison system, out of rehabilitation units, etc. And I got kind of sucked into this, and I realised what an absolutely fantastic service we do. And statistics kind of speak for themselves. So we provide a finite intervention. It's the maximum we ever spend with a woman is 3 hours. So an hour's career coaching, an hour's interview coaching, and an hour's dressing. And 72% of the women that we see through our doors at the centre go on to get a job in the first month that they have seen us. So we know that we're making a massive difference. Yeah. And halfway through that kind of tenure as a coach, I was approached to apply for a treasurer. So now they've got me both ways. So I coach, and I sit on the board, and we are, you know, we're a fantastic team, all very dedicated to it, and all, you know, all absolutely committed to making SmartWorks Leeds a bigger success than it already is, and reaching out to more and more women.
It's amazing. And we'll put a link to SmartWorks in the show notes for this, so we can do a bit of promo for you there. Speaking of being treasurer, you've got some exciting news about the treasury, haven't you? Tell us about that.
Again, you know, if we talk about imposter syndrome, I think I've got legitimate imposter syndrome. So I was approached last month to join the board of the, I can't even believe I'm saying it out loud, the HM Treasury Women in Finance Charter, which means that I sit with a cohort of about 15 people who are the conduit between 400 signatories of the charter and the treasury. So the signatories are all banks or building societies, insurance companies that have all signed up to the HM Treasury Women in Finance Charter, which is pledging, and it's to level up the gender pay gap, have more senior managers in executive positions and just senior managers, and actually introduce kind of relevant policies and procedures that support women in the workplace. Now, one of the big ones we've talked about is the reasonable adjustments for menopausal women policy, which we've delivered on now. So so that's very exciting, and I get to sit at the table with some very senior bankers, but we're all driven to I guess it's assimilating the information that the Treasury, so the Treasury has policies that they want to implement. Mm-hmm. And so we talk to the signatories about those policies, and the signatories will say, yeah, can do, no, don't think that's going to practically work in a business. So we're kind of a bit of an intermediary. But yeah, it's really exciting. And
it's amazing. What a huge compliment to your efforts and your work that you've put in. It's fantastic.
It is. And I think everything's kind of dovetailing together, because I was approached a couple of years ago, three, 2.5 years now, just to join the board of a fintech. So this is my paid non-exec position. And we are a fintech. So we are a lender that we've developed a platform so that we can pay invoices. So it's an invoice discounting platform. There's some embedded finance. There's a lot more to it than that, but I'm conscious we've got a small podcast, not a huge amount of time. And I was actually approached to apply for that because I am a typical user as a recruiter. Mm-hmm. So recruitment companies, especially temp ones, you know, have a requirement from time to time for invoice discounting for obvious reasons. So they actually they asked me to join because I could give that approach, but I think they've bitten off a bit more than they can chew, really, because what they've got is somebody whose key job at the bank was operational risk and governance. So I'm the one going, nah, you can't do that. And, oh, no, I think we should do that a different way. But I'm also encouraging them when we launch to become a member of the Women in Finance Charter so that we can be a beacon, if you like, for it.
Interesting. Here's a question. I think this will about round us off for today, which is really annoying because I'd love speaking to you. I'll have to come back on for another episode. But all those years ago, when you were assessing applications in your early banking career, would you have given you a loan if you'd have applied?
I mean,
and what entrepreneurial conclusions can we draw from this?
I would always say, I don't practice what I preach at all. You do need a business plan. You do need a strategy. As it happened, I was very lucky that I didn't actually need to go out and borrow some money at this point. But if I'd have had to go out and borrow some money, I'd have had to tap up a mate. And I'm sure that's illegal now. I'm sure you could actually go into prison for going to your mate in the bank and say, I know I don't meet the criteria, but could you just pop it through anyway? But one of the things that, and again, maybe this is the reason why I make a good recruiter, is that when I worked for the bank, one of my line managers once said to me, you should never apply for internal jobs and interview for them. Mm. We should just tell you what jobs we think you can do, because what you are really good at is interviewing well. So I can interview for a job that I couldn't do and get it. And I think I probably, if you put me face to face with a bank manager, I could blarney my way around getting a bank loan as well.
But that's the great thing about the recruitment industry, isn't it? Is that you need to be able to back yourself, and you need to be able to just trust that you're going to make the money, because it is such a wonderful meritocratic industry. Yes, and if you're good at what you do, and you know you're in it for the right reasons, then the world's your oyster. It really is.
And if you're genuine, and I know we're supposed to be wrapping this up, but one of the things that I'm quite passionate about, and I know that it's a thing, there's a lot goes on with interviews, criteria-based interview questions and scoring people. But actually, that can be quite a dangerous thing, because if you are the type of person that I am, you literally can skew those scores. Mm. You know how to skew those scores. You know how to do the values tests and all those kind of things. But the one of the key reasons I would definitely say to people, use a decent recruitment company, because we can tell you where the transferable skills are. If you're experienced in it, you speak to a candidate, you know whether they can do that job or not. Mm. Doesn't matter what's on that piece of paper or how many points they got out of 10 in an interview. It's trusting with your recruiter. It's having the relationship with your recruiter to know that when we recommend somebody, it's because we know that they're right.
Definitely, definitely. Right. Thank you, Tracy.
I'm exhausted.
It's been absolutely wonderful. I really, really appreciate your thoughts and your time. And yeah, I'll see you very soon.
Thank you.
That is it for today. Thank you so much for being here, and I hope you enjoyed the episode. Please don't forget to like, rate, and subscribe so you never miss an episode. And if we're not already, let's connect on LinkedIn. See you next time.